Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where long-term performance is driven by original, fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's a sad irony that's not lost on any of us who put this program together that a big part of our making a living these days involves telling you how many more Americans have lost their jobs. It's a task that's impossible to take lightly when the number is so scary for all of us. There are now 12.5 million looking for work. So today we set out to give that number some perspective. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Glad to have you with us on this TGI Friday, March 6th. Yes, you heard me right a moment ago. 12.5 million Americans are now looking for work. The unemployment rate hasn't been this high in more than a generation. More than 650,000 jobs were lost in the past month. Still, as bad as it is, our D.C. Bureau Chief John Dimsdale offers us this ray of hope from Washington. Some see signs of a bottom.
After Bureau of Labor Statistics Commissioner Keith Hall delivered the bad news to the Congressional Joint Economic Committee, Representative Carolyn Maloney had two questions.
Are there any bright spots in this month's jobs report? Is there any good news in our economy?
There are very few bright spots, if any, in this report. Labor market weakness is deep and broad across all industries and all demographic groups.
Nearly one in three manufacturing jobs have disappeared since the recession began, says Dave Huther with the National Association of Manufacturers.
The decline that's already taken place is actually greater than the average decline of all the recessions in the post-World War II era.
Some economists predict the jobless rate will hit 9% by this summer. John Fisher, who teaches business at the University of San Francisco, says that's the result of last year's hits to housing and banking.
There is a limit to these things. And I think the data that we're seeing in unemployment and related data is indicative to past damage in our economy and not that the economy is getting worse and worse. So I think we are nearing a bottom, both in the national unemployment data as well as the severity of the market corrections.
Fisher says now that construction's at a standstill, housing demand will finally outpace supply, and that should create jobs. He thinks stock market investors are overreacting to where we've been, rather than focusing on where we're going. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
If you're like me, you probably didn't think much about the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation until recently. It was a sticker on the door of your bank or an afterthought at the end of a commercial, member FDIC. Now, it's pretty well known that those four letters guarantee up to $250,000 of our own deposits if our bank hits the skids. Today, it turns out the FDIC needs some backing of its own. It's asking Congress for a $500 billion credit line with the U.S. Treasury for obvious reasons. But as Marketplace's Steve Henn reports, the request could also signal a change in strategy in the banking bailout.
Only yesterday, the House of Representatives gave the FDIC permission to borrow up to $100 billion from the U.S. Treasury.
That supposedly was going to be all that the FDIC needed.
Bert Ely's a banking consultant.
So I'm not sure at all why they feel they suddenly need $500 billion.
But Simon Johnson, a former IMF official, says he can't imagine what the agency might want to do with this money.
Yes, I can imagine. Of course. I think they're getting prepared, finally.
Johnson says this would give the FDIC enough cash to take over some of the biggest banks in America.
So yes, I think they're preparing for action vis-a-vis major banks.
The FDIC insures deposits in banks that fail. But a handful of banks in this country are so large, the fund doesn't have enough money for the FDIC to credibly threaten action. Bill Black, a former bank regulator, says the FDIC is supposed to be run like an insurance company. But
as an insurance company, the FDIC has been run extremely poorly.
For 10 years, from 1996 to 2006, healthy banks didn't have to pay a dime for FDIC insurance. Black says that left it short on cash when this crisis hit. Recently, the FDIC hiked premiums, and the agency says it has enough money to cover any expected bank failures. But, they say, this temporary half-trillion-dollar credit line is necessary, just in case. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
If you live in Denver, San Francisco, or Seattle, the bad news may be right on your doorstep. Or perhaps even worse, not showing up on your doorstep. The Rocky Mountain News is closed, the Chronicle is on the auction block, and now there's news the Seattle Post-Intelligencer will likely stop the presses and go online only next week, the first big city daily to do so. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports on what newspapers might look like in this brave new online world.
The Post-Intelligencer published the news on its own website late yesterday. The paper plans to go online only as early as next Tuesday unless a buyer materializes. About 20 employees out of 180 would reportedly remain. Reporter Hector Castro was asked to stick around, but to forego a severance package.
You're also looking at a cut in pay, a decrease in your medical benefits, no pension plan. It just seems like all the risk is on the people who want to try and work with this online venture.
Risk is the key word here, says media analyst Jeff Jarvis of the City University of New York. The risk that newspapers will fail if they don't transform their business model.
It's time that we try to find ways to free news from the limitations and expense of paper.
Jarvis says a large portion of a traditional newspaper's budget is ink, newsprint, and the people and gas to truck it around.
Get rid of that. Do what you do best and link to the rest. It starts to be possible to imagine an online-only operation of scale that could cover a city and be sustainable.
Newspaper analyst John Morton says this won't happen right away. Most papers will keep adding links and blogs, but without stopping the presses.
The internet advertising that's available isn't sufficient to fund very much journalism, which is why, you know, they're doing this, those papers that are doing it, with greatly reduced staffs.
At the Seattle PI, that will not include reporter Hector Castro. He turned down the job offer and is now looking at a career change. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The Dow and S&P 500 managed to struggle their way above water today. Not so NASDAQ. The details when we do the numbers. Today's unemployment news makes it painfully clear how many more victims the financial crisis is claiming every day. 651,000 more Americans out of work. And that's not just some statistic. It's a flesh-and-blood reading on what's happening out there. For some, the recession represents their first reversal of fortunes. But as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports, zigging in and out of work is becoming an all-too-familiar game of financial musical chairs for a lot of us.
We expect to trade up from job to job, but often for every two steps forward, there's one step back.
In the real world, things are not stationary. People's economic fortunes vary substantially from year to year.
University of Michigan economics professor Frank Stafford directs the panel study on income dynamics. It's tracked almost 8,000 families for 40 years.
Over the last few decades, there's been increasing variability in all the different aspects of life, ranging from income to people's wealth position to people's stability with employers.
Instability is something 31-year-old Todd Crost knows well. He had a job in Michigan as a sales rep, but his clients were tied to the auto industry. When the industry plunged, it took Todd with it.
I'm unemployed as of December 15th.
Now he's a stay-at-home dad. The family lives in the Detroit suburbs in a house that's worth about $40,000 less than they paid for it.
If I were to find another job somewhere else, it would be difficult for me to move.
It's also become more difficult to move up and attain a better standard of living than the last generation. John Morton is director of the Economic Mobility Project. He says that, adjusted for inflation, 30-somethings like Todd are making less than their parents did.
That median income has fallen by 12%. So the median income back in the mid-70s was around $40,000 for men in their 30s. Today it's around $35,000.
Looking back, Todd Crost says his dad's jobs got better and better.
Whereas mine, in hindsight, have been good, okay, bad, none.
Todd's dad, 55-year-old Mike Crost, lives near Peoria, Illinois. Like his son, he's also in sales.
I can remember in my early days that the jobs that I had were with employers who I got to know on a personal basis, where with my son, they seem to be just jobs and there's no relationship to the employer-employee.
The lack of social ties creates even more volatility, and it's getting worse. Reversals are happening faster, and they're more extreme. Some folks get shaken off the ladder and join the ranks of the poor, at least temporarily. Again, Frank Stafford.
The prevailing concept of poverty as some kind of a persistent condition is not correct.
40-year-old Michelle Patterson didn't know she was in jeopardy. The Newark, New Jersey native thought her company, which publishes educational books, was on solid ground.
I actually thought I had a secure job. I actually thought the company I had worked for was really recession-proof.
On paper, she'd done everything right. She got an MBA, she bought a condo, and she finally felt secure enough financially to concentrate on her personal life.
I signed up for eHarmony, and I've lost 40 pounds, and then this happens.
In January, she got laid off.
It did feel like going off a cliff.
In the midst of the worst recession since the Depression, how long will it take to bounce back? Frank Stafford says the trends aren't encouraging.
There have been more widespread incidents of what we could call a persistent shock. So you lose your job and you don't just take a year or so to get back on track and recover to your income, but a more protracted period.
That would be tough for Michelle Patterson. She has enough savings to last about 2 months. Her condo, that toehold on middle-class stability, is back on the market. Undaunted, she's looking for work full-time and hoping for a bounce that brings her back up. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
This was another one of those unforgettable weeks on Wall Street that we'd probably all like to forget, if only we could. But it's probably more productive to try to make some sense of it all. So joining us for our weekly wrap-up now, Andy Brooks, head of U.S. equity trading at T. Rowe Price, and Megan McArdle, editor for the Atlantic's Business Channel. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Hi, Bob.
So, Andy, let me have you lay back there on the couch, take a deep breath, let it out slowly. Tell me what's been troubling you this week. It's been a rough one, has it?
Boy, it really has been a rough week, and about all I can say is thank God it's Friday.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just been brutal.
You'd think that everyone would be used to the bad news and stop panicking at some point. What do you make of all the activity this week in particular?
Well, a couple things, it seems to me. One is every day people are waking up saying, I can't take it anymore. I need to sell. I need to protect whatever I have left. Secondly, I think on the margin, the game right now for those that play the game is to sell and to sell short and to put pressure on things. And it sort of feeds on itself. So the whole psychology is just terrible.
Well, Megan, I get a sense that President Obama is getting blamed for the declines in the market in the last 6 weeks. Is that fair?
I'm going to say that part of it is a fair cop, which is that the administration has been pretty shamefully lax in getting its house in order. And the Obama administration has been willing to spend political capital on things like a huge new budget, a very large stimulus plan, but they've not spent political capital on getting people appointed to Treasury. Timothy Geithner is trying to do this all alone with no deputies, and that's why when his sort of plan A didn't work out, he ended up in Congress saying, well, I'm going to fix things by fixing them. And that's a huge, huge problem. I think the Obama administration really needs to sit down and rethink its priorities and, you know, go back to focusing on getting the banking system fixed, because that is the one thing without which nothing else will do any good.
Andy, we all know that the market loathes uncertainty. Is the Obama administration sending clear signals yet?
Well, I don't think they're clear enough, and I'm certain that the president and his advisors fully appreciate, you know, how important the markets are to the country's psychology. So, you know, one of our mantras is we're just one day closer to the bottom because it's been awfully difficult. I would say, however, you know, the credit markets continue to improve, and that ought to allow, I would think, Megan, the banks a chance to start working better here as well.
Well, I mean, I think that that's right. When you look at things like the TED spread, it's clear that the liquidity crisis that we're having in the early part of the year has started to abate somewhat. That said, you've still got issues with no one can buy a car unless they've got credit that's better than 700. No one can get a mortgage unless they've got 20% down and sterling credit. Those are issues where you've got huge pileups of consumer durables.
Does it help or hurt having the president in the role of financial advisor, if you will, warning people not to panic? Andy?
Well, I think the president needs to lead, and people want to know that the president's in control and that we're making strident efforts to improve things. There's something else that's going on here that's related, which we really don't, I think, probably know how to address, and that is there's a question of confidence, right? And if people's confidence in an institution like Citi or Bank America or J.P. Morgan is driven by watching the stock price, it can be self-fulfilling. And a lot of people have been leaning on stock prices, selling stock short, pressuring those prices as a way to hedge out other instruments that they might have. And it's very destabilizing. And I think we've probably got some work to do to figure out how to make that better.
We started out talking about investors saying, I can't take this anymore. I had hopes we were seeing the investor capitulation that you expect at the bottom of a bull market way back in September. And then came November. Then we saw a 24% rally. Now we're back to these sickening dives again. When is it coming?
One of my friends who's a trader used to talk about this all the time because he worked at a small hedge shop. And he said that his boss was always saying, I think it's capitulated. And he would go, no, as long as you think it's capitulated, it hasn't capitulated. The point at which it will have capitulated is the point at which we all just give up and decide to put our money into canned goods and ammunition.
I think I'm about there, I'll tell you. Thank you very much. Andy Brooks, chief trader at T. Rowe Price, and Megan McArdle, editor for The Atlantic's Business Channel.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, a scary time for workers in Dubai.
They don't have any work. They have no means. There's nothing like welfare here, and people don't know what to do.
But first, let's do the numbers. After another wild week, Wall Street caught its collective breath today, leaving markets mixed. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 32 points, or 0.5%, to close at 6,626. The Nasdaq fell 5 points, or 0.4%, to end the day at 1,293. The S&P 500 rose 0.1%. That's less than a point, to finish at 683. The weekly tally tells the tale. The Dow dropped 6.2%. The Nasdaq gave back 6.1%. The S&P 500 slid by 7%. Apple lost 4% today after analysts downgraded its 2009 earnings estimate, and General Motors stock skidded another 22% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. Let us do the work for you. Download Marketplace's After the Bell, a podcast which makes sense of a week's worth of business news. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee holds a hearing on protecting individuals with disabilities. The National Association of Counties continues its legislative conference. The agenda, of course, addresses our current economic woes. And Barbie turns 50. Not only is she super stylish, she's super busy. Barbie's had 108 careers in her lifetime. What a doll. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon, in for Kai Rizdahl. We investors who've watched the value of our portfolios wither away could at least take some comfort in the dividend the stock might pay. But lately, there's not even much of a consolation prize. Wells Fargo slashed its dividend 85% today. The country's fourth largest bank says that'll save around $5 billion this year. Citigroup and AIG are still teetering on the edge of failure, and credit markets are still tight. So what should we try next to stabilize the financial services industry? Well, economist Todd Buchholz suggests the answer might be letting a new player into the game.
We've run out of escape routes for our banking crisis. Citibank has been swallowed up by the American taxpayer and by sheiks in Saudi Arabia and Abu Dhabi. Bank of America can't digest Merrill Lynch and the million-dollar window treatments in Merrill's CEO suite. President Obama has already corralled the big three, Paul Volcker, Warren Buffett, Prince Waleed bin Talal, but one more player perfectly positioned has not been called upon. Walmart. Yes, our national retailer offers three things in short supply: cash, respect, and a super sharp pencil when it comes to cost control. A few years ago, Walmart tried to enter banking, but was hounded by social critics and fearful competitors worrying that the retail giant was simply too powerful, too anti-union to get certified as a bank. But this anti-Walmart bias makes no sense in banking. Walmart critics accuse the company of cannibalizing downtown merchants. But most Americans don't drive to a downtown bank anyway. Critics hate Walmart for buying too many socks and shoes from China. Well, let's face it, America's banks already depend on China's thrifty savers. Critics condemn Walmart's non-union status. Well, I've never seen a unionized teller at a Citibank window. Have you? I don't think ATM robots are unionized either. Finally, Walmart haters accuse the firm of wasting natural resources. You know, too much styrofoam and plastic. I'm sure we could get Walmart bankers to promise not to give away lollipops with plastic wrappers on them. The point is, the U.S. needs some strong entities to enter banking, so we don't have to prop up failures or beg foreign sheiks and potentates for help. Moreover, Walmart might actually help customers. Its 3,800 stores have already driven down the price of wire transfers and check cashing. Maybe they could drive down the cost of these endless bailouts coming from Washington. Let's face it, this would be a tough call for President Obama. But hey, we're all looking for the real change he promised. More than spare change, I hope.
Todd Buchholz is the former White House economic advisor to the first President Bush. His latest book is New Ideas from Dead CEOs. We welcome your thoughts at marketplace.org. On the program yesterday, we reported on the plight of some of the white-collar expatriates in Dubai. As the once-booming economy there retreats, foreign workers are getting laid off and thrown out of the country. But one group of foreigners is suffering an even worse fate. Some of the South Asian laborers who built the city-state have lost their jobs and can't go home. From Dubai, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Selling spices in the souk or dealing in gold along the wharf, Indians have lived and worked in Dubai for more than a century. The Indian rupee was legal tender here before the local currency, the dirham. But it was the construction boom over the past decade and a half that swelled Dubai's South Asian population dramatically. More than 500,000 workers from India, Pakistan and Bangladesh came to build this city. Now the boom has fizzled out. It's some of these South Asian men who are bearing the brunt of the downturn.
We had one case where there were 26 men from Bangladesh. They had just been recruited. They just arrived here. The company became insolvent and the owners ran away, leaving them here.
Roger Tro is a British expatriate. He runs a charity in Dubai which helps Asian labourers in trouble. He says many of them have been marooned as the construction companies that brought them here have gone bust.
They don't have any work. They have no means. There's nothing like welfare here, and people don't know what to do.
We're talking about hundreds of people, or are we talking about thousands?
Thousands. Thousands.
I've come with Roger and a translator to a district called Satwa. We're in a ramshackle compound fenced in with rusty sheets of corrugated iron. Half a mile away, we can see some of the city's multi-billion dollar skyscrapers, brightly lit and glittering in the dusk. Some of the men who built those towers now live here in single-story squalor.
And they're living in very degraded conditions. This is what they're reduced to.
We've been invited into one of their houses.
Hi.
Hi.
Dozens of men are milling about, preparing food. Our translator is taken aback.
They have made a makeshift kitchen
and everybody's pitching in. But from the number of people that he's saying are staying here, I don't see how these guys can survive on such little food.
Or live in such a small house. We're told that in these seven rooms are 150 men. 40 of them have been laid off and depend on the meagre wages of those that are still working. Raj Jindran is 29 years old and comes from Tamil Nadu in southern India.
I am coming to 7 years old. People know no food now.
No food.
No food.
He says now, no work, no money for food, nowhere to stay. I stay with these people who are here because, you know, they're friends. And I just hope there's some way of somebody coming, you know, to save us.
The men have tried but failed to find work in Dubai. Now they just want the companies that brought them here to keep their promise to fly them home.
Thai also, many people die here. But no eating also, many problems.
He's trying to say that we have come to such a situation that if we can get a ticket back, we will be very happy because we've had enough living these kind of conditions.
They want to go home.
They want to go home.
Roger Troe says the big reputable construction companies in Dubai are fulfilling their obligations. Since the downturn began, they've flown home many thousands of laid-off staff. But many small Indian and Pakistani companies operating in Dubai have abandoned their workers here. The Indian and Pakistani authorities seem indifferent to their fate.
It's a no-win situation, and it's tragic. There's no other word for it. It's a tragedy here in Dubai.
The government of Dubai prides itself on its free market principles, but the problem of the stranded migrants gets worse every day. The government may have to intervene. In Dubai, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
My, how things have changed since Kai and our team took the program to Dubai just a year ago when business was booming and construction cranes dotted the skyline. For a further view of the contrast between then and now, check out our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, a preview of what may be coming in the week ahead. Bernard Madoff is expected to plead guilty to criminal charges next week in connection with the biggest investment fraud in history. There's word Madoff's lead attorney and federal prosecutors have signed a court document indicating he'll waive an indictment and offer a guilty plea. The once-respected Wall Street trader is accused of running a Ponzi scheme for decades before it collapsed in last year's market meltdown. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 32 points, 0.5%. The Nasdaq dropped 5 points, 0.4%. And the S&P 500 was almost flat, rising just 0.1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up Monday, celebrating one of this century's most popular blondes.
She's not quite 12 inches tall. She's made of plastic. She is so voluptuous that if she were blown up to adult size, she would, well, just tip over.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you're feeling better, Kai, and back here again on Monday.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.